really true either. So there was kind of a love, you're not really an academic kind of thing going on. But for me, in a time when numbers were getting more and more important, empirical research was the word of the day, still is, obviously, he gave credence to oral history. And so he, in a way, I always thought that he allowed me to do his work. And so writing this book, I'd say that this book began in my head maybe in the early 1990s, that I knew that I wanted to do something on studs. I didn't know exactly what it would be. And when I finished writing my book on Ruth First and Joe Slovo, it just seemed like, okay, this is the time I can do it. Mm-hmm. And so that's what led to the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, initially, you know, doing a book on South Africa and the apartheid struggle might not seem to have this direct connection to Studs Terkel, but you make a, you know, you really foreground his anti-racist work as kind of a lifelong part of his involvement in Chicago politics and really in global politics.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think it's really interesting because I have people that I interviewed in South Africa for various projects who've become friends, and they keep telling me, oh my gosh, I look way more forward to your book on Studs Terkel than I did on the others. And Studs had actually spent time in South Africa during apartheid. And he struggled with going. You know, it was like BDS today. It was long before the 80s when there were bans on going to South Africa during apartheid. It was in 1963. And he brought, I don't mean that he invented it at all, but he went to South Africa to do oral histories. Mm-hmm. And he, it was the full gamut of society. So he interviewed white people who were privileged, who some were thrilled that there was apartheid, others knew that it was wrong, but also knew to be white was to live in pretty well. And then he interviewed African miners, not even South Africans, people that were brought into the country to work in the mines. And he interviewed struggle leaders too. So it was a full gamut of people. And for me, it was very, very connecting because one of his guides in South Africa was Nobel Prize novelist Nadine Gordimer, and she ended up doing the foreword for my book on Ruth and Joe, which is just amazing coincidence, and they became very good friends, actually. So the political connection, the belief in conversation were all connected, and I think the whole interviewing and doing life stories and oral histories in South Africa probably has more prominence than it does here.
You definitely, I think, foreground the pleasure that Studs took in interviewing the unsung, right, everyday person, right? Even though your book is very much a who's who of the left, as Terkel's life just intersected with so many leftist,
absolutely,
struggles.
I think somehow he saw humor in the connections. So, for example, when he started winning awards, he kept joking every time that, imagine being a celebrity for interviewing those that are uncelebrated. You know, that was one of his many, many lines as he got older, and he had various ones. But I think that he was involved in political things at such a young age, and it never stopped. And because of that, he interviewed people who worked for Republic Steel, but also interviewed people like Nader. And he made the same kind of connections, no matter who it was. One of the people I interviewed is a guy called Jamie Calvin, who Studs referred to as a guerrilla journalist. And Jamie Calvin's take on Studs, there's various takes on Studs, but one of them was that he was willing to learn from everybody and anybody, and he thought that was the only way that you could learn. And so he put himself out there. I was thinking about that as I was driving over, that I was driving down Burnside, there was crazy traffic, and it hit me that Studs Terkel never drove a car. And part of the conversations were on the bus. People would get on a bus and they'd hear his voice and they knew that there was going to be a conversation right away. And he was always ready to learn from the people that he met. He talked a lot too, but he listened as he talked.
Yeah, that discussion of the experience on the bus is a really kind of beautiful.
Yeah, so he was very, very comfortable in many, many settings, but extremely comfortable with working people.
You talk about kind of the history of his learning to listen and to converse is rooted partly in his family's experience of running a boarding house during the Depression.
Yeah, absolutely. A men's hotel. And it was in Tower Town and very close to this place called Bughouse Square where there were political speeches going on. And Studs's dad was a big, loved Eugene Debs, and he would listen to him on radio with Studs when he was a teenager. And then as a youth, he would go to Bughouse Square and also in his 20s where there would be these political speeches. And so he sort of, his education was the Wobblies. That's a little bit of an exaggeration, but he grew up on that. And then by the time in college, I mean, he went to the University of Chicago and went to law school there too, never practiced, but he went there and he said first and foremost about his education were the record stores at the bus stops in the black neighborhoods on the South Side. I've mentioned before that he got all these awards and honors, and to him, I think the most important one, or the one he enjoyed the most, was he, at the time, was the only white person in the African American Literary Hall of Fame. And Chicago writer Haki Matabuti, who actually gave me a poem to use as the afterword that he wrote after Studs died in 2008, said, you know, Studs Terkel was one of the few people I knew that it was a shake of the hand, meaning that he could always be trusted in the world. And that went with politics, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and how did did he do a book on jazz, or was that just research that he'd done on jazz?
No, he did do a book, and it's a book that I don't claim to have a great handle on. At one point, there was a second author. He did interview the who's who of jazz in the 50s, and the book came out long before he wrote another book, long before he was an author. So I think it had to do with being around musicians. He would talk about his teachers, and two of his teachers were African-American music people. One was Big Bill Brunzi, a blues guy who Studs absolutely adored, and who he toured with, actually, in the Midwest. And the second was Mahalia Jackson. And the interesting thing about Studs and politics and race was both of those people were involved in a story where Studs reflected. And Studs didn't reflect on emotions, almost never. But he did reflect on ideas, and in terms of race, the two were connected, emotions and ideas. So with both people, he had a story where he was not sensitive to the racism they faced. The one with Bill Brunzi was they were going to do a gig at Purdue University in Indiana, and they were hungry, and they came up to some diner or bar or something, and they were going to go in and get a sandwich, and Bill Brunzi said, just bring me a ham sandwich. And they all, Studs mostly, but the other people too, kind of chastised him. What are you talking about? You don't know these people. They're not going to, they'll be fine. It's a working man's place. And they walked in, and the bartender said, good evening, gentlemen. I can serve three of the four of you. And Studs was oblivious until it happened. And then the other was with Mahalia, and Studs, they were tired. It was after her show. He was the MC to her radio show for a while, and it was a national show on CBS. And they wanted to go to a restaurant in the Wrigley building, and Wrigley was a racist. I mean, horrible in many, many ways. And Mahalia said, you know, we don't really want to go there, Studs. And he was pushy. And finally he gave in, and he said, what am I thinking? You know, in reflection, of course they shouldn't want to go to that restaurant, but I wasn't sensitive to what they were going through. And he had a number of other learning experiences like that that are major, I think.
Mm-hmm. And he was also at the March on Washington, right?
Yeah, definitely. In fact, he had just come back from South Africa. And so he had gone to South Africa in 63, and then he... And again, interesting part of that was that his wife Ida, who he always said was more political than he was the one that nurtured that. Come on, we need to do that. And Studs spent the whole time documenting it. He interviewed people on the train. There 800 people, I think, went on train from Chicago to Washington. And then he interviewed people on the ground at the march. And the documentation was for the moment, but now we have it all. And his shows are being digitized right now. WFMT, his radio station, is doing this massive digitizing of his shows. So they're available, and it's amazing to listen to them at this point. So Studs, before that, and till the day he died, was a third-party guy. Every day, including, again, this morning, every day when I see something about the election, I think, wow, I wish that I could hear Studs talking about it.
Or Studs and Howard Zinn together.
Well, yeah, exactly. Howard Wynn and Zinn, the same thing. But Studs was, so in 48, for example, he was not just a supporter, but a vocal and active supporter of Henry Wallace's bid for the presidency. And in that, he came to know Paul Robeson well, and Paul Robeson was persona non grata in the United States at the time. So Studs had this TV show in the 50s called Studs Place, and it was one of three shows that were called the School of Chicago Television. And the other two made it to New York, and Studs didn't because he wouldn't sign a loyalty oath. He was confronted by NBC executives. He was ready to go to New York. It took place in a greasy spoon diner. David Schwimmer, the actor who was friends with Studs, referred to it as Cheers written by Clifford Odets, which I think is a great line, okay? And Studs was blacklisted to the point that the show was banned, and he had a difficult time finding work because of that and because of people in Chicago that pushed that. On the other hand, he was upset that when his friends were called before UAC, and he wasn't. Like, why wasn't I called? I'm every bit as radical as they are.
I think you make the connection in the book between the blacklisting in the 50s and some of the criticism that he came under later on in his life. Post 9/11, he made some comments that earned him some heat.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the eulogies, which wasn't really a eulogy, I forget the author, but it was in the New York Times right after Studs died, and it was pure red baiting. And Victor Novosky, who was the editor of The Nation River, said, Studs would have loved this. You know, he said, blacklisted in the 50s, red baited in 2008. It would have made his life.
Yeah. So very critical of the war in Iraq, very critical of the Patriot Act.
He was part of a suit against AT&T about bugging phones, about giving information.
NSA wiretapping.
Yeah, about wiretapping. He was part of this lawsuit. He was 95 years old. I mean, it's absolutely amazing.
Yeah. It really is a fascinating read. Just the way his life intersects with so many movements and so many luminary figures of the left. It's really, really quite fascinating. So the reading is coming up on August 30th at Broadway Books at 7 p.m. And the book is Studs Terkel, Politics, Culture, and Mostly Conversation. I've been speaking today with Alan Weider. And thank you so much for being here today.
This has been Desiree Helligers for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
And that's the great Mahalia Jackson with Troubles of the World. Jackson being one of the people that Studs Terkel worked with, as we just heard from Alan Weider in his conversation with Desiree Helliger. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour here on KBOO in Portland. I'm Clayton Margridge. Now here is our book mole, Larry Bolden, to tell us about Any Human Heart by William Boyd. Larry.
Good morning. As I'm sure must be true of many dedicated, perhaps I should say obsessive readers, when I find an author I really like, I tend to read up everything of theirs I can find. William Boyd is a reader's delight, not only because he's an excellent writer, but because he's written so much. Today I want to talk to you about one of his most ingenious novels, published in 2004, Any Human Heart. He begins with a quote from Henry James, "Never say you know the last word about any human heart," close quote. Boyd proposes to describe what he can of one human heart, that of Logan Monstuart, by giving the reader a set of intimate journals beginning in 1912, when Logan is 6 years old, and ending with his death in 1991. What is amazing to me is that while those journals really read as if they are memoirs, the character and the journals are spun out of air. Boyd takes us through nearly the entire century, the school journal, boarding school, the Oxford journal, two London journals, World War II journal, a New York journal, an African journal, and a French journal. The imagination required to create and flesh out this life simply stuns me, and Logan meets many of the writers and artists of the century who then play into the complexity of the story. Boyd has done his homework as he takes his characters through a long and complicated life. The voice of Logan is really established in the school journal when Logan is 17, and that very convincing voice is carried throughout. Not only do we meet Logan, but also his two most important male friends, and their lives are chronicled as well in surprising detail. Quoting from the book, "We keep a journal to entrap that collection of selves that forms us, the individual human being. The true journal intime understands this fact and doesn't try to posit any order or hierarchy, doesn't try to judge or analyze. I am all of these different people. All these different people are me." Close quote. The voice established in the boarding school journal is that of a bright but rather arrogant, pedantic, and judgmental young man who, with his similarly arrogant friends, is trying to put up with the boredom of their last years in school. Waiting for their real lives to begin, they do this by noting the magnificent acts, or sub-magnificent acts, that each perform. Logan insists, however, that they can't simply wait for these acts to happen. Quote, "It was no good, I said, just waiting for the various categories of munificence to happen. We had to initiate them ourselves," close quote. He proposes to do that by having two of the boys think up tasks for the third that must, so far as possible, be witnessed and documented by the other two. Against the boarding school tradition of addressing other boys by their surnames, Peter Scabius, Ben Leaping, and Logan Monstuart begin to call each other Pete, Ben, and Logan. They decide that Leaping, who is Jewish, has to become a Roman Catholic and has to be considered as fit for the priesthood. Scabius is to seduce an older girl who lives on a farm close to the school, a witness kiss to be the ultimate test. And Logan, who has contempt for all sports and sportsmen, is set the task of winning school colors for rugby and must make the first team. While the schoolboy tricks and dares in the first journal make for humorous reading, it is soon apparent that all three boys are more than supercilious students who are contemptuous of their peers and their teachers, as Boyd begins to explore the depths of their very human hearts. Logan has a particularly close relationship with his father, who's quite weak and frail even as Logan is growing up, and he dies at a young age. "The day father," quoting from the book, "the day father was buried, my faith, such as it was, went with him into the grave. Shelley was so right. Atheism is an absolute necessity. In this world of ours, if we are to survive as individuals, we can only rely on those resources provided by our human spirit. Appeals to a deity or deities are only a form of pretense. We might as well howl at the moon," close quote. The self-absorption and vanity of the narrator in this pretend memoir is presented more baldly than were this a real memoir. Even in telling of my worst deeds, I think I would be less flippant in my self-description and self-evaluation. Although in the prologue we are told there will be no analysis or evaluation, only bare description, we feel Boyd's analysis and value judging as we should. In his depiction of the sexual relations between men and women, especially moneyed men and poor women, he describes the times he is writing about in ways that expose the inequalities, the power issues. Still, there's a privileged class mentality in his male characters, even those Boyd seems to want to like and want us to like. I suppose what I want to say is that there's not sufficient attention paid to class issues. Intellectual snobbery is also a class issue. He sometimes reads a bit too much like Fitzgerald, interesting stories about the complex inner lives of privileged people. As amazing as Boyd's understanding of history and incorporating it into his novels is, I'm even more amazed by the difference of content and tone from novel to novel. Yesterday I finished his Brazzaville Beach, which has to do with primate behavior and the scientists who study it. It's hard for me to even imagine the research he has had to have done about primatologists, about Jane Goodall in particular, and other prominent field scientists. So his research skills feed his incredible imagination as he unwinds these stories, exposes these worlds. He writes complex spy novels, love mysteries, and novels about murderous chimpanzees. What's next? I will leave you with one other Loganism, a self-justification dreamed up as simply an essential, wired-in part of his nature. Men must be men, must heed the existential call. Quote, "Why did I wait so long? I must never let this damaging frustration build up again. I have to recognize that I'm simply not equipped temperamentally to stay at home and live a circumscribed rural English life. I'm essentially urban by nature, and also the prospect and reality of travel. Otherwise, I'll desiccate and die." Close quote. I've been talking to you about William Boyd's novel, Any Human Heart. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Thank you, Larry. And that concludes the Old Mole Variety Hour for today. If there's any part of the show that you'd like to hear again, search for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO's website. That's kboo.fm. And you'll find links to this show and many others. Today's show will be available in a day or two. Check us out on Facebook and Twitter for announcements of upcoming shows and links to those that have been posted. I'm Clayton Morgridge. Our engineer today is Patsy Kullberg. I want to thank Bill Resnick and Dan Handelman for their discussion of policing in Portland, Desiree Helligers and Alan Weeder for their conversation about Alan's new book on Studs Terkel. Alan will be reading from his new book at Broadway Books in Portland on August 30th at 7 p.m. And thanks again to Larry Bolden for another fine book review. I've read quite a few novels after hearing about them first from Larry. Tune in again next week for more news, views, reviews, and interviews from the Old Mole's underground perspective. And stay tuned to KBOO, because at 10, it's Air Cascadia, locally produced news, views, interviews, headlines, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, it's Locus Focus with our host, Barbara Bernstein. Today's guest is energy expert Richard Heinberg, co-author of the recent book, Our Renewable Future. At 11, we'll hear Disability Awareness with host Grace Eagle Reed, a monthly show about issues affecting people with disabilities and their communities. And at 11:30, it's Voices for the Animals with host Courtney Scott. Today's guest is Lisa Brisley, one of the key organizers for the Global March for Elephants and Rhinos, which is happening in Portland for the first time this year.
I'm a fool if I fall again, and yet I'm enthralled by its call again. You say you love me, I know from the past. You mean to love me, but these things don't last. Fools rush in to begin new love affairs. But tonight, my dear, who cares? Fun to be fooled, fun to pretend, fun to believe love is unending. Thought I was done, still it is fun being fooled again. Nice when you tell all that you feel. Nice to be told this is the real thing. Fun to be kissed, fun to exist, to be fooled again. It's that old devil moon having his fling once more, selling me spring. Love is king once more. Fun to be fooled, fun to pretend.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Pan-African Women's Day, Saturday, August 27th at In Other Words Bookstore in Portland. A panel of African women from different organizations will be highlighting the issues impacting African women across the globe, and to highlight the necessity for African women to be united and organized on a worldwide basis against imperialism. Edutainment and childcare will be provided. Again,